operating out of the United States, Japan, Singapore, the United Arab Emirates, India, and Europe, Tantra is a sort of one-stop, AI-first, IP-enabled ecosystem. Overseeing it is its founder and chairman, Mehul Desai, a veteran and a pioneer of mobile wallet and payment innovation, fintech, information and communications technology, and new economy applications worldwide. With 150-plus patents to his name, Mehul, who is based in Orlando, has a special passion for India, where his company has a significant base. As someone who has traveled around the world for 30-plus years, tech-vangelizing, Mehul is now involved in deploying technological solutions in finance, health, education, and new economy applications. He spoke to MCR from Orlando in Florida.
Welcome to Mayank Shah Reports, Mehul. It's a great pleasure to have you.
No, likewise, Mayank Bhai. It's a pleasure and honor. It's been a while, so I really appreciate the opportunity and look forward to the conversation.
Oh, likewise. Mehul, you've been deploying technology across sectors around the world for over 3 decades now. And obviously, you travel extensively. So describe to me what you see in terms of where the world is as a technological civilization now.
Yes. So no, I, Mayank Bhai, I truly have been blessed. I've had an opportunity to do lots of interesting things in interesting places over the last almost now 35 years. You know, my professional journey has taken me across every major market. You know, as you're aware, while I live and work out of the U.S., I've had an opportunity to work across lots of different markets, lots of different verticals, industries, and most importantly, with lots of different and interesting people all around the world. And so when I think about technology, I started building intellectual property, patents, products, eventually companies, got to dabble a little bit on the government side as well. And we'll talk a little bit more about this later on as it comes up. But what really intrigues me is innovation at large. And so to give a little twist to your question on how do I perceive the world and how it uses technology, embraces technology or not. I personally think of it in context of innovation. You know, lots of different ways to define innovation. But in my mind, technology typically conjures up a relatively recent phenomenon, which, as you know very well, is not true at all. You know, as humanoids right. evolving to humans to where we are now, we've always been technologically advanced, and what really has been driving societal progress is innovation. And right. so in context of innovation, when I think about innovation around the world, I believe innovation, one, is still largely inefficient. And I say this with all the love and respect for my fellow innovators. We all mean well. We are all very sincere. But in my observation, innovation is still largely inefficient. As in, it still boils down to throwing a bunch of things at the wall and seeing what sticks.
Right.
Clearly, while there will always be a part science and a part art to innovation, goes without saying, I don't think we, as entrepreneurs, innovators, enterprises, government, society at large, have done enough to figure out how to get the science of innovation right so that we can take the guesswork out of the science and let the art continue to play out. I'm not saying that it will be all science and no art. On the contrary, I'm a big believer that it has to be part science, part art. And the art is what keeps it interesting, clearly.
Right.
But none of that means that we should take the eyes or take the ball off the of the efficiency part. So that's my first observation. My second observation over the years is innovation is not inclusive. And obviously, we all know the headlines. But Partly, this is because of how innovation evolves, the structural elements of how innovation evolves in some ways don't lend to inclusive innovation, at least right off the bat. Over time, yes, but you know, it's always going to be in spurts, so to say.
Right.
But as part of that, though, my kind of deeper observation is that it's not inclusive, not because of some of the obvious factors of resources and advancement and political will and political system and geopolitics. I mean, there are lots of headline factors, right, which we all are fairly well aware of, and for the larger part, we all agree. But what I've found, interestingly, over the years, and this is one of the fundamental things that we are trying to solve for with Tantra, is that in most environments, enterprises in general, organizations, government agencies, wherever I've had an opportunity to work, interact, collaborate, make an impact over the years, innovation is disjointed from lifelong learning of the participants in the innovation ecosystem, is further disconnected or disjointed from the execution or impact. And in my mind, that's one of the structural things which essentially drives both the inefficiencies in innovation, as well as the lack of inclusiveness that we all would love to have from innovation. And so my second big observation is that not only is innovation not inclusive, but its fundamental components of how innovation gets linked into its participants' lifelong learning and further into the execution and impact are disconnected. There are lots of different capabilities, ideas, methodologies around innovation management. Separately, lots of different ideas around lifelong learning. At least now, you know, a lot of people seem to be latching onto that. And then clearly, lots of different ideas, methodologies, advancements when it comes to execution. But what I found very intriguing is that these three, which if you think about it intuitively, should be connected, driving each other, almost cyclical in many ways. One leads to the other, and so on. For some reason, has always been disjointed, disconnected. And my third observation, especially as we now are very well into the AI, AGI age, is innovation is not sustainable. You know, you don't have to look far. Just look at the data which comes out of these large AI data centers and just imagine the carbon footprint, at least in terms of the current context of how these large data centers are being built. So to answer your question, really three key observations. It's not efficient. It's not inclusive, and it's not sustainable.
Yeah. Mehul, that's an interesting segue. You mentioned AI and AGI. You know, with the rise of every technology over the decades or centuries, perhaps, there is always the initial debate about the haves and the have-nots. When the radio happened, we talked about it. When the phone happened, when mobile phones came, with broadband, but now with AI and AGI, how do you look at inequities in terms of whether they would become worse than what we have now, or AI and AGI might bridge the gap? Where are you on that particular question?
So in terms of the inequities, I think it becomes worse before it starts getting better. And this is not me looking into a crystal ball and making some bold prediction. This is just the history of all innovation, mind you. If you think about it, when the innovation or technology first, you know, comes into play, it is going to evolve in bits and spurts, as we talked about earlier. And then as it starts to percolate across the broader universe,
right,
things start to settle down. When it comes to AI in particular, I personally have been working with AI, have been involved with AI for, I would say, three of the five big hype cycles. And I call them hype cycles because all technologies evolve that way. You know, with every hype cycle, there is a signal and there is a noise. I'm a telecommunication engineer by trade, so I think of signal to noise ratios all the time. There's always a signal and there is always noise. And over time, the signal gets reinforced and the noise fades away. And so with AI, of course, when it first started, I wasn't born. The second wave, I was too young. By the third and fourth and now the fifth wave, as I see it, is well upon us. I have been working with AI and have been leveraging AI and have been doing interesting things with AI. And what I find is that, yes, today the disparity, the inequities, as you call them, are very much there. Some of it is related to just any new technology as it evolves. And with every hype cycle, there's a little bit of the new which kicks in and a lot of the old which gets reinforced. And, you know, AI is no different. But the other reason why I believe with AI we are feeling it more, and we are going to feel it even more as we go towards general purpose AI. Again, the AI proponents believe that it's already here. The pessimists believe that it can never be achieved. Let's just say pragmatically we're somewhere in between.
Right.
So whether it's AI or AGI, I believe the inequities will be more pronounced and partly because of just the nature of how technology advances in general, but also because of the underlying components that are driving AI's evolution today. If you think about it, there are three fundamental components. Over and above, of course, the AI algorithms and so on. One is data, as in access to large sets of data. By some account, the current AI models have already consumed all the data out there as part of its training and evolution, right? So just to put that in context for your audience, when we talk about large data, I mean, we're talking about really large data sets. So one is data and all the investment focus on where will the data come from to train the AI engines and the algorithms. Two, it's hardware. Again, it's in the news all the time. I think most people can relate to it, whether it's chipsets, which manufacturer, you know, not a day goes by where there isn't something controversial happening around AI chipsets in some part of the world. And the third is energy, because these large data centers are consuming and will continue to consume, at least the way the current technology is progressing, large amounts of energy. And some of the comparisons are just unreal. Right.
Right.
You know, these data centers consume more than what a major metropolitan city would need. Right. Again, to put it in context. So because the AI evolution today is fundamentally driven by largely these three underlying components, the inequities and disparities are going to be even more pronounced because there are only a handful of countries, companies, you know, out there which have the kind of resources that these three right now are consuming. And there's a race. And for reasons that I can relate to, whoever gets to kind of that promised land of AGI, however you know, qualify it, quantify it, there are huge efficiencies in store. And again, we'll talk about what we call Tantra super economies and Tantra human relevance in context of this progression of AI to AGI. But so, yes, whether it's just how technology in general develops, or whether it's the underlying components which are driving the current wave hype cycle of AI, inequities, disparity is bound to be there. But I'm a firm believer. I'm an eternal optimist. Again, history teaches us that it's a matter of time. You know, over time, a lot of these elements will get commoditized. Again, the Industrial Revolution took about 100 years. From kind of the point where the early technologies, you know, started to come around to the point where the whole world started to really get the benefits of it. The knowledge age, the information age, which followed after that, this evolution, when the technologies came in to when they started to get, let's just call it commoditized, was a lot shorter. And with AI, the prediction is it's going to be even shorter, which is the good news. But what that means is in the short term, there is going to be tremendous disparity. You know, as an example, to again give this little bit more context, and as you are aware, we were involved in the early kind of development of mobile wallets, mobile commerce, mobile payment. As a matter of fact, when I started working on all of this, the term fintech did not exist. Right. We just applied technology to solve for financial friction. Now there is a huge entire industry which evolves around fintech. But more importantly, what we started to build bottoms up, literally the nuts and bolts back in the early 90s, I would argue today is commoditized. And not only is it commoditized, but practically every other major industry looks at this as the underlying plumbing. Whether you're doing something innovative in the healthcare space, you leverage the plumbing that a lot of the fintech, you know, early technology innovation put in place in government services, education, on and on. And so I believe the same will apply to AI. But yes, in the short term, the inequities, the disparity is very much going to be there, partly because that's how all new technology evolution works, and partly because the underlying components of AI just kind of lend itself better to countries and companies which have, you know, a lot more resources and access to the kind of technology, you know, people that they would need.
To digress a little bit, you mentioned your early involvement with mobile payment, etc. But must say for the benefit of my viewers that Mehul was a key figure along with Sam Pitroda in pioneering mobile payment technology, which India has really taken to unlike any other country in the world now. I want your perspective on why you think India has galloped on mobile payments so dramatically, unlike even where we live in the U.S.
Ah, okay. Well, this is a topic which could take up a few hours in itself, so I'll try and be brief. And obviously, okay. This is a topic which is very close to my heart, both fintech in general and then India in particular. I think there are a lot of different reasons and factors for it. And now lots of, you know, business school case studies have been done on it. So I don't think I'm going to share something which is not already out there. Some of it just had to do with leapfrogging. You know, a lot of different technologies, underlying technologies played a part in terms of how mobile transactions came around. India had an opportunity to leapfrog a lot of them. And so partly it was just that. Partly it was how India started to grow, the middle class in particular, how the young people in India started to become more and more confident and assertive, and they continue to be, which is tremendous and heartwarming. As we all know, you know, young people are the early adopters and they embraced it. And now when I go to India, and I go back to India often, it's just amazing how their entire life revolves around anything and everything mobile, right? I mean, as a matter of fact, I believe there are times when it's counterproductive and almost borderline scary, but, you know, they seem to make it work for themselves, and more power to them. And so I think while there are a whole bunch of demographical factors and also economical factors, if I had to put a finger, and I have said this publicly in the past, if I had to put a finger on one event, I would actually put a finger on the demonetization that India did many years ago. And I remember at that time, I was asked by a journalist in India. I was in India visiting and for some work. And a journalist asked me, again, in context of my background specific to mobile transactions, wallet, commerce, payment. And at that time, demonetization was a very contentious issue. And I said that, look, while I can't comment on the politics of it, I'm not a politician. As a technocrat, what I can tell you is demonetization is India's Asian Games moment. And the reason why I drew the parallel to the Asian Games is, Mayank Bhai, not to age you, but you are old enough. If you think about India, before it hosted its first Asian Games, there were hardly any color TVs in India. And the reason was simple, right? There wasn't anything on TV in India which warranted a color television set. Black and white was fine, right? There were two programs, probably, broadcasted by the government broadcaster. Okay, and black and white held up perfectly fine. Jokes aside, when India hosted the Asian Games, the number of color television sets that were bought in India just skyrocketed. The reason was simple, right? Now people had a reason to go out and buy a color TV because there was something worth watching on those color television sets. And so I drew the parallel to the Asian Games, saying that demonetization is that kind of a trigger. It triggered, and I'm almost positive if you go back and look at all the data in terms of India's use of mobile commerce, mobile payment, mobile transactions in general, demonetization became that trigger. The same way Asian Games were the trigger for color television adoption in India. And since then, you know, we've not looked back as people right. in India. And we found all kinds of interesting uses for it. And we continue to, you know, find our own way of leveraging it. So lots of different factors, some technical, some political, some socioeconomical. But I would say demography has probably been one of the single biggest factors in terms of how it's adopted and continues to adopt.
Right. Not to belabor the point, but what you're describing in terms of demonetization and the explosion of the way Indians use mobile for everything, I think it's a bit of an unintended consequence. I don't think the policymakers had any of that in mind when they demonetized. It was just a completely knee-jerk action, which whose consequences we know, but that's not the subject that I would like you to get involved in, but I thought I should point it out. And now that brings me to your company, Tantra. I was going through the background, and in short, the way you describe it is it says it enables entrepreneurs to enterprise and others to translate ideas into risk-mitigated innovation. Now, that's it's a very broad description of what you do. But again, it's a very important job that Tantra seems to be doing from whatever I've read so far. You focus on building patents, products, and people, as you described once again. Now, I would come to the patents part separately because India, I think, has a serious problem of not being able to do remarkable work in patents area. But tell me about Tantra and what it is that you're trying to do through that.
No, great question. For that, just to set the context and background, as we discussed earlier, I've now spent about 30-35 years building and deploying technology all around the world.
Right.
You know, did a lot of the early pioneering work around mobile commerce, mobile payment, mobile wallets. We talked about that. We had an opportunity to build a company out of Chicago, out of the US, and we sold that to MasterCard. And after that, I had an opportunity to build a few more companies, some based on ideas that I had, some based on ideas that friends like you, collaborators around the world had. And it was a mixed bag. You know, some worked, some did not. I ended up selling a couple of companies. I ended up shutting down a couple. A few were put on the back burner. One exception to kind of what I would call the 0 to 10. You know, personally, I enjoy the 0 to 10. Take an idea, file a patent. My discipline is to file patents first, not with the intent to go out and sue people, but really to crystallize for myself and the group that I'm working with, the company eventually that I set up, exactly what is it that we are creating that is unique? How does it sit in the existing value chain? And effectively, how can we build all of this in tandem? In my case, I love the 0 to 10. Other people look at friction and they think of friction as a problem. I look at friction and I think of it as an opportunity, as a challenge. And I'm not the only one. You know, there are lots of us out there who always look at the glass as being half full. And so in my case, I've always done kind of look at friction, turn it into an opportunity, take a patent position, build a product, eventually build a company. And I, over time, ended up with about 12 to 14 companies. The only exception to that was one large company where it was an existing global financial service provider, at that point, very old school, they reached out to me. They wanted me to help them evolve it into a new economy, fintech. I'd never done anything at that scale before. This was, you know, operating in 170 markets, highly regulated. And I thought this would be interesting. So I did that. I helped them build a global fintech strategy. Then they said, look, we want to go public. I'd never been involved in taking a company public before. So I said, okay, this will be interesting. So I did that. And then luck would have it, a huge scandal hit their parent group, and I had an opportunity to preside over that until the new buyers came in. So as I tell friends like you, I couldn't have paid for an education like that. But the reason I bring it up is between all of the things that I've done in the 0 to 10, and as I mentioned earlier before, I've also had an opportunity to look at innovation from the government side. For several years, I used to be part of a task force at the U.S. Federal Reserve in the early days of mobile money, when the U.S. government agencies were looking at mobile money in context of everything from monetary risk to monetary policy to even national security. And so I had a tremendous time learning and participating and looking at how government and regulators in particular have to deal with innovation. And so come 2020, as the pandemic was well upon all of us, everything was shut down. I started to sketch and I said, look, eventually we all will come out of this. And when we come out of it, what is it that I'm going to work on for the next 5 to 10 years? I typically like to kind of think of 5 to 10 year plans and then start working backwards. And as I kind of thought through all the things that I had done up till that point, what really intrigued me once again was innovation. I've been involved in so many different products and so many different companies and markets and verticals, fintech, health tech, ed tech, you know, government tech, or you name it. But what I really wanted to figure out was innovation. How can we do it efficiently? How can it be more inclusive? And how can it be made sustainable? Because if we fix that, then in a sense, we've created what I call the utility of innovation. And effectively, the usability of innovation can flourish on top of it, right? Again, as a telecom engineer, I think of everything in context of utility and usability. Utility is like the infrastructure. The usability is the last mile. And so innovation in general is no different, right? And we can relate to this in context of everything from electricity to gas to water, plumbing. If it did not have all these utilities, we would not be able to build our respective last miles on top of it. Product development is no different. Innovation should not be any different. And so I started to sketch this out. I said, this is interesting. You know, I took all the lessons I had learned, the hard lessons I had learned, the mistakes I had made, things which had worked, and I started to organize them. And essentially what I came up with were a series of foundational blocks to basically take the science of innovation and put it on steroids, leaving enough room for the art of innovation to flourish. And once again, I did this for two reasons. You know, yes, I was always intrigued by it, but given that I had up to that point, and I'm talking about 2020 now, early 2020, I had already built several companies, sold a few, shut down a few. What I realized is this is not very efficient as an individual either. You know, as an individual, there's only so much time, resources, and bandwidth I have. And as much as I love jumping into everything that I see and I want to be a part of figuring out how to build it and scale it, once again, it's not that efficient. So I wanted to create a sandbox for myself and people like me. There are lots of people like us out there who could use this kind of a sandbox. And so Tantra effectively became that, Mahendra. It was partly my learnings and observations of 30 plus years around innovation in all of these different settings, from small entrepreneurs or, you know, small companies, entrepreneurs, two guys in a garage, proverbial, all the way to large enterprises, you know, even government agencies. I wanted to take all of those learnings and distill them down into the infrastructure of innovation, the utility layer of innovation, so that now anyone that I met, whether it's an individual with an interesting idea, a company which is trying to figure out what to do next to survive for the next 20 years, I could bring them into my sandbox and effectively they all could get something from it. And so the tagline for Tantra, and so this is the backdrop, this is the context. So the tagline for Tantra is, we are an AI first, intellectual property enabled global innovation ecosystem. Again, it's a mouthful by design. I kind of think of myself sometimes as a stand-up comedian, exaggerating to get the attention of the room. And every time I say Tantra, okay, especially outside of India, people kind of do a double take on it. Some people have heard of Tantric and don't quite understand what Tantric means. Kinds of weird images conjure up in their mind. But the minute I say Tantra, they say, Mehul, what does Tantra mean? And I said, I'm glad you asked. There's a reason why we decided to call the company Tantra. And so Tantra, as you know, in Sanskrit is the right way, the right method, the right process of enlightenment.
Right.
For us, Tantra is the right way, the right method, the right process for innovation. And that's why we decided to call it Tantra. And so as I started to sketch it out, we now have, in the last 5 years, built out three very distinct offerings. And we've been leveraging AI, and we've been building not only AI capabilities, but people for the last 5+ years, because this was always, a means to an end for us. This isn't something new that we latched onto as part of this current hype cycle. And so at Tantra, we have fundamentally three offerings, mind you. One is our AI-led platforms. We've designed a series of platforms for enterprises which allow them to efficiently innovate, systematically apply the different gates of innovation, again, augmented by both AI as well as what I call the people in the room. It's important to strike that balance between AI and the domain people expertise that you already have and that you want to nurture. And we designed this around five gates, market risk mitigation, intellectual property risk mitigation, technology risk mitigation, compliance, regulatory risk mitigation, and then finally business model risk mitigation. Two, we then link it into the participants' lifelong learning. If you're a company with employees, you use your own efficient innovation processes, methodology, to link it into how your employees, your partners, your ecosystem learns and grows. And then finally, we further link it down to the impact, the execution of whatever it is that your employees and partners are building. And so as I mentioned earlier, when you asked me about my observations around innovation in general, this was one of the most intriguing things that I found, where there are lots of platforms and methodologies out there to bring efficiency into innovation. There are some for lifelong learning, and there are some for execution, but there is nothing out there which looks at this in as a continuum. So we have a series of platforms which are designed for enterprises to do all of these things. Some want to do it separately. Some want to start with one and then go to the other. Again, we've designed it in such a way that it's extremely flexible. We have our own standalone AI platforms. We have our platforms designed for the manufacturing environment. So we have a series of our AI platforms which are designed towards innovation enablement, innovation efficiency acceleration, but more importantly, linking it into lifelong learning and then further linking it into execution and impact across the enterprise, across the ecosystem. We have a series of what we call advisory practices. We have an AI practice. So one of the biggest needs of the hour, I believe, around the world, we talk again to companies, we talk to government agencies, is to help them figure out how to fit a round peg into a round hole. That's the biggest issue with AI today. I read an interesting statistic. MIT has published a report where they claim that 95% of companies are not realizing, or I think the term they use was zero return on their AGI investment.
I see.
Right? They specifically call it zero return, and the number they have is 95. Now, okay, even if you say maybe they're off, it can't be 95, maybe it's 75. Even if you say it's not zero, maybe it has to be 5%. Doesn't matter, right? But I do believe that. I believe that most companies around the world, whether it's because of their peers, because of their board, because of, what their competitors are doing, okay, they're all latching onto AI, which is good. There are a lot of benefits there. But then they're struggling to figure out how to A, leverage AI as far as their own businesses are concerned, and B, more importantly, how to balance it with the human capital that they already have.
Right.
And so at Tantra, we built a series of advisory. Our AI practice helps companies do that. Similarly, we have an IP practice. So for me, intellectual property boils down to what I call the three Ps: patents, products, and people. Patents is, you know, how do I distill down my contribution, my secret sauce, and how does it fit into the value chain? Product, again, it can get manifested as a service, a solution, doesn't matter. Okay, but how do I manifest my secret sauce? And then finally, the most important part about intellectual property is the people. If you don't have the people, if you don't build the people with the innovation, and if you do not hold on to the people, no piece of paper or a product is eventually going to give you the ability to differentiate and scale whatever innovation you're building. So we have an IP practice. We have a full-blown incubator, which helps entrepreneurs and companies leverage all of these capabilities to build out not only a business plan, but an IP-led business plan. And we have our own venture fund. I've raised a lot of capital over the years, small capital, you know, big capital. And what I've found is there's a fundamental disconnect in that industry. There are people who invest money, and I am an investor, so I can relate to that, who look at ROI, the return on their investment. But then there are people who need to raise money, the innovators, the entrepreneurs. They are wedded to their innovation, as they should be. If they're not passionate about their innovation, then how are they going to figure out how to make it work? The problem is both of these ends don't typically meet.
Correct.
And so with our venture fund, we wanted to find a way to solve for that. So the second big area of offerings that we have at Tantra are under what we call advisory. The third is our engineering practice. You know, eventually ideas have to get built out. They have to get manifested. And we have engineering services with deep domain expertise around fintech, health tech, ed tech. And all of this is designed to say, okay, whatever idea you have, we can help you manifest it, whether it's IP driven or otherwise, whether it's AI enabled or otherwise. At the end of the day, if it's innovation, it gets distilled down, it has to get manifested, and that's where engineering comes in.
Right.
So we have three different set of offerings. Now, along with this, by design, I wanted to bring in what I would call, to be polite, a self-reinforcing ecosystem. When I think of Silicon Valley, when I think of Redmond, Boston, Tokyo, Singapore, Tel Aviv, and I'm just taking a few examples. These are highly incestuous innovation ecosystems, and not incestuous in a negative, bad way, but in a positive way. And it works. Wall Street, is self-reinforcing. Each of these ecosystems that I've been involved in over the years works partly because they are self-reinforcing. And so with Tantra, I wanted to build a global self-reinforcing ecosystem. And so on day one, I planted five flags. We're based out of the US. We picked certain markets in the EU that made sense to us. We over time combined the GCC with India as a market for various reasons, Singapore and Japan. And through these five regions, we basically operate in lots of different markets around the world. And then finally, I wanted to build a series of what we now call super use cases. So earlier I made a reference to the Tantra super economies. I recently read a very interesting economist report, which basically talked about GDP growth. And it said that between 1700s to the late 1800s, global GDP, you know, quadrupled from what it was prior to 1700. Prior to 1700, I believe they measured it at 0.1%. Between 1700s to late 1800s, because of the Industrial Revolution, it quadrupled, which was a huge jump, 2.5%. And then up to now, in the information age, knowledge age, it's been growing at a steady clip, right? 2, 3, 4, 5%, you know, good years, bad years, what have you. The most interesting thing, as they pointed out, is with AI and AGI even more so, the AI proponents predict that global economy will grow at 20 to 30%. Now, once again, you may be a pessimist, an AI pessimist, and you might say it can't be top 7%, maybe 10%, not that different from what we're doing today, a little better maybe. You may be an optimist and say, no, 30%, You could be a pragmatist and you could fall somewhere in between. The point is, it is going to be a huge jump. And as they distill down why the economy grew between the industrial age all the way to the AI, AGI age, they singled in on ideas. In the industrial age, because it freed up a lot of people and gave them a lot of time, they had the ability to start thinking about ideas and turning those ideas into meaningful things. So now, given where we are, if AI and AGI is going to help us out with lots of ideas, and again, not a day goes by when I read about the impact AI could have for the cure of cancer or sustainability or what have you. The immediate question which pops to my mind is, who is going to help you take these ideas and turn them into risk mitigated, executable innovation? And Tantra is designed to do that. So we've now built a series of reference use cases that we take to enterprises, in some case, large consortiums, which already have government policy to bring around big impact. And we help them systematically take ideas and apply risk mitigation to make them executable in such a way that the innovation is efficient, inclusive, sustainable. Same thing with human relevance, right? If you think about it, AI has the ability to, you know, take a lot of repetitive tasks and do them a lot better than what you and me as humans would do. But as the joke goes, I don't think I would go to a robot or AI for a haircut. You know, I don't need it as much now, but you do. But jokes aside, if you don't figure out the right human AI balance, at the end of the day, societal progress will falter. And this goes back to some of the questions you asked me earlier on disparity, inequities, whether it's AI related, technology in general related. And so what we've done is, because once again, we've always built our platforms, our practices all around people, saying you have to find a way to build the people. You have to find a way to balance out the AI capabilities with the humans in the room. Innovation has to be linked into lifelong learning of all of its participants. We've built a very interesting reference solution for enterprises and government agencies that we call Tantra Human Relevance. Why should we as society solve for, I'll just take an example, how to retool Pennsylvania coal miners? It's a failure on our part as society. We should not have been put in this situation, starting with them. We should never be in this situation. We should have solved for this long before the time came when coal mining was no longer going to be relevant. And so how do we now make sure, with all the technological progress, AI in particular, AGI, you know, as it's coming or creeping up on us, that humans will continue to be relevant? We have to stay two steps ahead of it. And once again, it comes down to this linkage between innovation, lifelong learning, and impact. And so we've now built a very interesting set of reference solutions, leveraging all the different building blocks at Tantra to help enterprises, you know, larger ecosystems, educational organizations who are trying to figure out human relevance. We've built a now interesting reference solution to help them bring around human relevance. And so this is, you know, again, to break it down, a lot of different tactical offerings supported by a global ecosystem, self-reinforcing domain experts, further supported by interesting reference solutions. And this is what we do. We work with entrepreneurs who come into our incubator with interesting ideas, all the way to large enterprises, to even now government agencies. And fundamentally, as Tantra, our charter is the same everywhere.
Just last couple of things, Mehul. One is, of course, you have about 150 plus patents assigned to you personally. I want your take on how you look at the Indian scene, especially where we tend to over-celebrate the idea of Jugaad. Now, Jugaad is very important in the Indian context, but Jugaad cannot become a national policy. These piecemeal patchwork solutions that we exult over every time somebody comes up with it. So I want you to talk about, I mean, we are in the 33rd year of the economic reform, if you consider 1992 as the origin of it. In the last 33 years, India has not had a single globally recognized app or product. It I don't know why that is, but that seems that is real. That is the reality we are facing. Tell me why it is that, and do you think there is a fundamental change happening in India in terms of mindset about innovating something that has a global relevance?
Yes, I do. This is a very interesting question, and I'll try and be brief and as structured as possible. Clearly, as people of Indian origin, we are creative and we are innovators. I mean, in the US, people of Indian origin are at the forefront of creativity and innovation and technological advancement and you name it. India in general over the last several hundred years, I mean, thousands of years ago, we used to create everything and the world consumed it. But in the last few hundred years, for various reasons, we seem to have lost that edge. I agree with you. And I believe, again, there are tactical elements to it and there are strategic or part almost philosophical elements to it. For some reason, as a people in India, we have started to focus more on consumption than creation. I think this is a mindset issue, mind play. You know, consumption is not bad. We all need to consume to survive. But we have to go back to becoming creative, saying, what is it that I'm creating? It just comes down to the mindset, right? So I find people who are in a hurry in India who want to take something which has been created somewhere else, you know, tweak it a little bit, and ship it out. Okay. Rather than saying, I'm going to solve for this problem and build something from scratch, right? We've become almost a country of traders. I hate to, you know, put it that way. And this was not the case and it should not be the case. Right? Some of it is more strategic. It goes back to, again, the usability of innovation, whether it's, you know, government policy, whether it's public-private partnerships, whether it's subsidies, whether it's political will. I mean, there are a whole bunch of different elements. And again, none of which I don't think India can't figure out and can't solve for. Absolutely has the ability to figure out both the utility of innovation and creativity, as well as the usability. As a matter of fact, with the young people and the kind of confidence that I see, if the utility is in place, the usability will just explode. And we're already starting to see it with the young people there. So I think it's part strategic. It's part tactical. But at the end of the day, as people, I think it's a mindset thing. I think we have to basically say that, look, I want to start creating things. I'm going to look at friction, embrace it, and look at it as an opportunity and a challenge and not as a problem. And start shopping for things which are out there. You know, you mentioned Jugaad. So I joke with friends outside of India all the time that in India, everyone thinks outside of the box. You don't have to go to business school to learn how to think outside of the box in India. And the reason for that is there is no room inside the box. Thinking outside of the box in the US is a luxury.
Right.
Okay. In India, thinking outside of the box is how you survive. Because there are no resources. There are not enough resources inside of the box. Now, this is good. It makes you and me feel warm and fuzzy and we can write interesting, you know, books on this. But the problem with Jugaad is it doesn't scale.
Absolutely.
And so once again, if you don't have a proper utility, you are not going to be able to scale. Utility is what fundamentally helps you scale. Usability is what drives adoption. Adoption and scale are driven by very different factors, very different, you know, elements are involved. And so whether it's Jugaad, whether it's systematically, you know, innovating, you know, another not so recent, but development is this whole hoopla around H-1B visas. I this debate comes up from time to time because Indian companies, I believe the statistic I read, I hope I'm not wrong, is 70% of the H-1B visas that the U.S. hands out are picked up by Indian companies. And every time this debate comes up, and not to be insensitive to the families and companies that are impacted by this new rule around H-1B visas, but every time this debate comes up, a part of me cringes. Why is it that as Indians, we think of ourselves, we distill ourselves down to a number? as opposed to saying, look, we could be a creative force for good. Let's find a way to unleash that creativity. Okay, let's use this, okay, to say, let's put the usability in place, let's put the utility in place, and let's unleash our creativity, as opposed to saying that someone is going to distill me down to a number. So I know I've bounced around a little bit with your question, but going back to kind of how do you fundamentally fix it? First off, I think we have all the know-how and understanding as Indians in India. I don't think that is lacking. I do think, you know, the utility part of this is better built and served through public policy, public-private partnerships, political will, government agencies, you know, the usability part, entrepreneurs and enterprises will then pick it up and run with it. Social entrepreneurs, you name it, right? Commercial, they will all run with it. And India has a lot going for itself. I mean, we're a democracy. At the end of the day, if enough people in India decide that we want to become a creative force for good, India can make it happen.
Absolutely. On that note, Mehul, I want to thank you for your time. I had a very interesting time engaging you, as it always is. We've been friends for a very long time, and we used to solve a lot of global problems over lunch sessions. So I thought this would be one of them, but it was fascinating. Thank you. I greatly appreciate your time.
No, thank you. On the contrary, I missed those sessions, Mayank Bhai. And so I actually want to thank you for the opportunity. And thank your audience for indulging us. But no, thank you. And very much look forward to the next opportunity to do it, whether it's with your audience or just one-on-one.